forum is on sexual abuse, breaking the silence. It's mainly an open forum, a chance to hear your views, your opinions, interaction amongst each other. But we've pulled a few people out of the community tonight just to get us started. Each hopefully from a somewhat different angle, and each of our panelists will speak tonight for about 4 or 5 minutes, and then I'll function as timekeeper as well here, and then we'll open it up to all of you to hear about your own experience and some of your own issues on this fairly broad topic. Tonight's panelists are Diane, Ingrid, and Bill, and we'll go in that order as well. So if you want to start us off, Diane. Oh, and I should just say, sorry, just a couple ground rules, excuse me. We'll end at 9:30, formally end anyway, so that you can have a chance to go. If people want to stick around and talk some more, that's fine, but we will take a break at 9:30. And also, just to say about forums that hold, sometimes on these really controversial issues, things get kind of hot as views are flying, which is great. Just try to do it in a spirit of listening to one another and hearing different viewpoints. The goal is not to come to a consensus or agreement at the end, but simply to have learned something from one another. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
First of all, I have not studied this area. I just sort of lived it through friends and community, church, and somewhat with young children. And I think that's where I think I'll start, because my field is early childhood, specifically early childhood special education. And the children I work with very often don't have words to get what they need or what they want, or to stop people from doing things to them. And so I have been about the past year teaching adults how to give children the words they need to not be victims. And I don't think it's just children with special needs that need that opportunity, but all of us. One of the things that I really encourage teachers to do when, for instance, well, maybe I can just do a quick little role play here. Ingrid, why don't you go ahead and hit her gently. Okay, tell her, stop, don't hit me.
Stop, Ingrid, don't hit me anymore.
Okay.
I give up, I won't.
Yeah. They won't, of course, they won't happen, and you deal with the behavior. But the idea is to give the words to the person who's been hurt, instead of giving the attention and the focus on the one that's doing the hurting. And this way, when you give the words, it empowers them. And the adult is there, but the person who's been hurt has some power to then take back. And in our community right now, I'm kind of leading up to, two things have happened in just the last couple of years in churches. In one church, a church that I belonged to a few years ago, 3 years ago, a pastor needed to leave because of rumors, and there were never any charges, and they were never, to my knowledge, substantiated, that he was having an affair with a youth worker of the church. And they were both married and both had families. That situation, even though it was never officially named, labeled, what have you, sort of blew up, and that church now, 3 years later, is having basically a mass exodus. And they're all coming across the river. I live in Mankato, and this church is in North Mankato, and everybody's coming to Mankato to church. So the effects have been devastating. I think some of the people from that church have decided to leave and start their own church. And the person who the charges were against was a very fine person in terms of a pastor and my personal experiences with him. So the community had a lot to do with ruining, in my opinion, this person's ministry in Mankato, and he's had to leave with his family. And the church is still struggling to recover. Most recently, in Mankato, and this one hit the papers, and you can read letters to the editor almost weekly or weekly about it. And that situation is that a pastor in a very large Lutheran congregation was accused and formally charged for sexual misconduct. And the story in the paper was that the pastor went to counsel a parishioner in her home, and he said that he had a beer and a couple of aspirin because of a backache, and then asked the parishioner for a back rub. And the charge, and as far as I know, this is the only charge that's come forth, is that he inappropriately hugged her. Now this case has been dragged through the papers. Can't go anywhere in Mankato, which is the size of about 50,000 people, without hearing people talk about it. And what I see is the same pattern kind of developing, that this family won't be able to stay. It's a husband and wife that are both pastors of the church. And the devastation, again, people leaving the church. People, and I don't know, I'd be really interested in other people's perspective about this. Something that I think is unfortunate is that the members of the congregation have just written these letters of tremendous support of their pastor. But we really don't know what happened. And it's almost like I felt like people needed to hold back to find out the story or to have it tried. But I don't know. I don't know about that.
But, well, that's a good way to leave it.
Yeah.
Okay, next, Ingrid. Then we'll take responses from all of you in a couple minutes.
Barb asked me to talk in the panel because she knows that I'm the sexual harassment officer in my institution, which means that I deal with college students who make complaints or have feelings that they've been harassed sexually. And I have been doing this kind of work more or less for 20 years, so I have a fair amount of experience with college kids. What I've read about it is that there, when a college kid, when any woman or person makes a charge of sexual harassment against someone else, it's almost always true. The statistics are very, very high. You know, it's not 100%, but it's high. I don't have my materials with me, so I can't tell you what they are. I also know that from a college student's point of view, when a teacher or someone in authority over them makes some kind of sexual approach to them, and it might not even be overtly sexual, it might be praising them too much, inappropriately, wanting them to be their assistant, and something feels icky about the way it's set up, or hanging around them. If they're in the program that I work with, the students all do internships somewhere in the city, and so they go and work for somebody in a social service agency or somewhere. And their supervisor sort of sticks to them and leaves a little slime, but they can't identify what it is exactly. But it's traumatic for them. It affects even the slightest thing like that affects their success, their work, their grades. I would say that you can look at college students' grades, and if a student has been sort of a B student for 2 years, and all of a sudden they're in the middle of a semester, their grade point average drops, they suddenly quit performing. If it's a woman, I'm almost guarantee you that she's been sexually harassed or she's been raped. And the colleges then tend to go on and victimize a student by flunking them out and giving them a lot of disapproval for their behavior at that point, instead of assuming that there's a problem that they need support and help and love and all that stuff. But it is traumatic. Even the little stuff is traumatic. I'll tell you what my first response is when someone comes into my office and says this, or calls me and says this. My first response is to completely believe them and to ask, you know, I try to get face to face with them in my office. If it's an internship situation, I say to them, before we even begin, I want you to know that you don't ever have to go back there. You never have to speak to that person again. You don't have to have anything else to do with them. I'll do it all. That's maybe not the right route. And my second response is, we'll talk about what is the right route, what would be the best for you, how do you want to handle it, what kind of support do you need, where are you coming from on this, what would make you feel the best, But I walk them through every step of what they're going to go through, if they're going to confront the person, how they're going to do it, who they're going to do it with, what they want the result, or the net outcome to be. With college students and their teachers, they almost always want the outcome to be that the person stops. They don't want the person fired, they don't want the person in trouble, they want the person to stop. Leave them alone. And it's so important that that gets heard and that that gets accomplished, because a kid's career could be ruined. Kids drop out of college, it's just awful what it does to women in our society when this isn't handled well. It's almost never that a student says to me, I will never go back there, I'm going to take you up on your offer. Usually we can come to some other resolution that turns out to be healthier for them, but when they do choose that resolution, that's the resolution we go with, and I think that's really important. Then I want to say one little thing about prevention. In our school, prevention is a group activity. We talk about it. We do trainings on sexual harassment with every new group of students that comes. We name it, we talk about the various ways that it manifests itself, what it is, and we do it with our faculty, with our staff. And so that nobody can pretend they don't know what's going on, because it's discussed as a public thing, in a group, in the beginning. And so that students then feel empowered to defend themselves, to keep their integrity as people. Then they also feel that they can come to us to redress past grievances, they can work out some past stuff. But it's a group activity, and I think in any group situation it could be. In a parish, in a school, in any situation, it's something you can do a training on, and you can get out in the public, and I think that puts a lid on a lot of it. Definitions and stuff like that we might want to get into later tonight, but those are my main points that I wanted to start with.
Thanks. And Bill.
When Barb and I talked about this, we went through a wide range of subjects and topics, two of which I'm going to mention and then drop and come back to them later if we want to, because I really like to go back to what you were saying to start, and I think that's what I'd like to speak mostly about. Barb and I talked about, and I just want to throw this out here so we know that if we want to come back to it, we can. One of the ideas is it ever possible after there's been sexual misconduct to have some kind of restoration either back into that particular corporate community, that church, or in another church? And we were kicking around some ideas about, we do some things around that with families, with offenders, with children, and it takes a long time, and there's some very specific kind of ground rules, and maybe we can talk about that. I don't know if we can do that. But, you know, there are some ways that we talk about making those kinds of steps with very strict ways of looking at that. Another piece we talked about was, and I really would like to get back to this, is talking about touching and hugging and all of those kinds of issues. And let me just make a statement that I made to Barb when we talked about this, that the more that I work with in this whole area, and the more that I work with female victims, one of the decisions that I've made is that I don't initiate any kind of hugs. And even if I do, someone initiates a hug with me, I generally will do side hugs. I don't do front or genital hugs. There is some intrusiveness in that I have some real concerns about. Now, I like hugs a whole bunch, and I like it if we have some kind of a ground rule and someone initiates a hug with me. But that's just something to think about, you know, and what all that means and how people play into that. Now, having said those two things that I'm not going to talk about, this whole issue about the pastor I'm either fortunate enough or unlucky enough or all of the above to be involved in a number of different roles, and I've been on both sides of that. I've been expert witnesses in court for expert witness in court for people who've been accused trying to get them off, and I've been for putting people in jail, and I play both roles. One of the things that I know with children, with sexual misconduct, with churches, I don't have an answer for this. I will just say to you that I know it's an area in our society today, even though we try to phrase it a different way, you're guilty until you're proven innocent. You know, that's the way it is. And I'm not sure that's not right. I'm just saying that's the way it is. That, if, pardon me, if you're in the public school system in the state of Washington, in anything that even comes close to sounding like, at least in the school districts that I work with, that sounds like it might be a possibility, you're out of there that day. You don't show up at 8 o'clock the next morning. They will stop you at your home or whatever until an investigation is held, and it'll hopefully it happens in a week or two, and hopefully the investigation is well handled and you're back in the classroom. Boy, there's just so many sides to that. You know, that's very, that's an incredible relief for safety for victims. That's real scary for the other, you know? I mean, boy, talk about a tender, difficult issue. And all I can do is say that my long-term experience is, you know, long-term meaning the years that I've worked in this field, is that most of the time, high statistical amount of the time, when people say they're abused, and that invariably when I work with offenders over a period of time, and I don't always get to do that, but invariably when I work with offenders over a period of time, we call it the dribble theory, you know, in 2 months we get so much, and in 4 months we get so much, in 6 months, and in a year, and invariably all of that stuff comes out, and yes, it was true. Now, but that's a limited experience. I haven't worked with, I've worked with a few hundred, I haven't worked with a million, so, you know, so it's real scary, and yet my leaning is, with great fear and trepidation and an incredible amount of respect for wanting people not to get just crucified, I have a sense that the first move has to be toward supporting and protecting the victim and other people who may be victimized. Full well understanding that that's pretty scary if somebody levels that at you. And you want to hope that the systems are well in place, that it gets looked at rapidly and looked at well, and that doesn't always happen. So I'll shut up. That ought to be enough controversy to get everybody rolling.
Oh, thanks. I should say, obviously, one voice missing tonight, and I considered trying to invite this from the community, is someone who actually wants to talk about their story of having been a victim of sexual abuse. So just to remind us of the very high percentage of people who have experienced this in our society, and certainly in the room here at Holden Village, there are many victims. At the school where I go now, Harvard Divinity School, it's estimated that half of the women students have experienced incest or rape or sexual abuse, so that it's very widespread and extremely painful for people. So just to say, we are not represented with that viewpoint here tonight, but are certainly open to hearing stories that include that as well from some of you. Okay, who wants to start responding to any of our topics so far, any of our panelists? And just in case you don't have anything to say, I threw some questions on the board here as far as what the church's role is in any of this, as support to victims or perpetrators, or is itself a perpetrator in some respects. What, who do you connect with some of the stories you've heard here about Carl? And then
I'd be interested in hearing Ingrid's, what their approach is legally. And my experiences with colleges is the whole idea of trying to handle things internally, and all with assaults and rapes is, you know, it does involve the legal system is in a way enabling for the abuser that you know, somehow this is okay because you're in college. And you know, where I went to school, where I was a hall director in South Dakota, there was one case that came up of, it was a gang rape type of situation. And that was one case out of, you know, umpteen that actually went on. And I'm wondering if that is more, you know, part of approach is legal.
I think a lot of people think that it's about 1 out of 10 rapes gets reported. Rape is, of course, against the law everywhere. Various other forms of harassment are not, and different institutions make different policies. And in fact, it's quite a recent thing that institutions, educational institutions, do make policies about sexual harassment. But they stop short of talking about rape because that's a legal affair. Most of our colleges, I think, I serve 14 colleges in a consortium, and I think a lot of them would prefer to cover it up or deal with it internally. But of course, the victim, who maybe can be influenced by counseling and steered, but often the victim does not want to go through the trauma of a trial or, you know, making it public. And if your job, as mine is to focus on the victim and try to meet their needs, then there are lots of ways that you meet their needs without making it public. One of the things that victims often want is not to have to publicly face the perp, the guy. And, you know, if that's what the victim needs, then they can't lodge formal charges, because if you lodge formal charges of harassment in a college, my colleges, then you have to face it. And so the students go through a lot of questions about how far they're willing to take it. They always want the person talked with and dealt with and discussed. And when I do that, I do it very, very privately, but I never do it alone. I do it with two other people. Witnesses, you know, the victim can choose one.
Stay here. Do you want to continue, Amber?
Sure.
That's the fire crew.
Try to focus your eyes.
Well, you do think it's you. You know, I thought it was the way I was behaving.
Mm-hmm. How about others of you? This could be, I mean, everybody's discussion here. If you have insights or questions or...
Well, I'd like to make a comment. I'm from Eugene, Oregon, and I'm a psychotherapist there and have worked with survivors of sexual abuse, primarily incest and childhood abuse, for the last 13 years. And actually, I end up here today at this discussion. But I'm in private practice, and my work is primarily with adult women who were sexually abused as children, where the possibility of legal prosecution, I mean, that's gone. What's left are the emotional scars that the adult women carry because of the hurts that they experienced as children. And just in terms of your theme, sexual abuse breaking the silence, I would just like to comment that even though this is something that may have happened 20, 30, 40 years ago, that if you are a survivor, that there are some hurts that you may be carrying and that may be affecting your intimate relationships with your children, with your partners, with your family members right now. And I would support you to think about breaking the silence around it.
I just want to say it feels really good to see the focus on the victims, and that little model that you do with Ingrid and Barbara, I thought was real neat, because we usually focus on the offender. And I really related to what you said about not being given the tools for dealing with a situation like that. And the thing about smiling and being pleasant, you know, and just really being at a loss and taking responsibility for that. I'm really encouraged by the kinds of programs that you have in Ingrid. I guess a concern tonight is some of the things that are going on in society that we've all seen the statistics about the percentage of boys that think that date rape is okay, and even the percentage of women that think that date rape or acquaintance rape is okay, and just that whole mentality, that kind of aggressive sexual behavior. And if anybody has any comments on that, where that comes from and what might be done about it.
I think in my mind, what we need to focus on in terms of that is teaching our children again at a young age to read signs, to trust themselves, and to give them words, to actually give them strong words with tone at a young age so they can practice, so that when they're in situations and say, this doesn't feel right, and click, it's there, boom. And that's kind of what you're doing by labeling for your staff and for people at that age. And what I'm thinking is that we should condition that at a really young age.
I've dealt with a lot of college men on date rape and taught, you know, tried to work it through and tried to get them to think about it. And it's hard, but, you know, a lot of them, once they think about how they would feel if the situation were reversed, sometimes that helps. Sometimes it helps to do some role playing. Sometimes it helps to talk about there. I think where it comes from in many cases is a lack of respect for women in our society, a lack of taking women seriously, an assumption that women are less than men or have less will or have less knowledge of themselves or have less efficacy or aren't as important. Women are property of men, and when you challenge all those assumptions, then they see that it's not appropriate. But it's very tough. It's real common in our colleges for a lot of men to feel it's almost a macho thing that they're supposed to do this. And when women say no, sexually no, no, I don't want to, no, I won't, no.
No means no.
No means no. But to those young guys, no seems to mean yes for some reason. And when I ask them, you know, sometimes I just sort of ask them to unpack that, explain why they think that and how they think that. And the more questions you ask, the more they squirm in their chairs until finally it's clear to them that this is preposterous. But, I mean, it's tough because it is a real milieu on college campuses, at least.
I'm interested in what you all think about this issue of, you touched on it initially, Diane, about sort of the question of, are we overreacting? Maybe you've talked both about how painful it is to be a victim, but also how painful it is when this kind of thing gets sort of becomes the substance of a community's conversation, and especially when it's unsubstantiated yet or whatever. And then, Bill, you also alluded to that, or you didn't allude to it, you talked about it, saying that someone is presumed guilty until innocent. Do you all think that we're overreacting to this now in the church? Is it too far that direction, or no?
That there's no way this man could possibly do this. And I feel like that's such a disservice to the victim and also to him. Because it doesn't leave him any room. If there is, you know, if he knows within himself that there's something that needs to be dealt with, it certainly does not leave him a lot of space to do that. If he's got all these people denying for him. I don't know. I don't know the situation.
One of the things that, and I don't know that situation, and I always get in fear of the fact that any of us who are in at-risk positions by, and in my workshop I was talking about the difference between being at risk and vulnerable. And vulnerable is the victim, and at risk is the person who takes the power position. And we're in an at-risk position, and we've got to be real crisp about our boundaries and careful and pay attention to what we do and what we touch and what we don't touch and how we hug and all like that. But it's still scary to think of, I might get nailed when I didn't do anything. You know, that's frightening to think about. And yet it seems to me that our balance, because of the way our society has ignored victims for so long, it's like, I don't know what else we can do other than side with victims and hope that we don't overreact. One of my senses is that we, particularly with church people, one of my senses is that we sort of do two things, neither of which I think is appropriate. We either let it go, sweep it under the rug, or we just absolutely crucify somebody and throw them out as if they're, you know, absolutely worthless and a non-restorable human being, a throwaway person. And we sort of like do both of those, neither of which is okay. I'm talking about the offender now. But that neither one of those responses is okay in my eyes. But we don't do much, we're not real good at doing much in the middle. And part of that, I think, is because I've not been responsive to victims, male or female. And so as we're in a groundswell of all that, and there is a voice being heard for victims, it's sort of like the backlash now, what we have to all live with.
And maybe one thing, I don't know, I'm certainly in a at-risk profession, I guess, as a pastor, and I'm sure many of you in this room are too, as teachers, counselors, whatever. I hate to think of it. It seems like sometimes now I hear in synod circles or whatever, people are just talking about, well, how can we sort of cover our tracks?
What? Turn the tape off, baby.
But or how can we, you know, not get in positions where somebody could accuse us of anything? But maybe we should be turning around thinking, I don't want to be a perpetrator. I don't want anybody to perceive me as one. I mean, in this guy's situation, you could put the best possible construct on it and say, he did go to her house just to counsel her, and she misinterpreted him. But the fact is, she perceived him as a perpetrator. She perceived that he did violence against her and that it was very awful. And I never want to give someone that feeling. So maybe that's what we can talk about as professionals too, is how to not communicate wrongly and how to learn ourselves, not just how to keep out of jail or how to keep out of the newspapers, but how to not ever harm another person and do touch them in a way that they don't want or do violence to them as well.
That's very important. Right on, Barb.
So what's the answer? Does anybody else wonder about that or struggle with that?
Yes.
We talk about it in our program because we're a sort of huggy staff, you know, and we've always been, but in recent years we've decided never to initiate a hug, and we do much more side hugs, and, you know, we don't, with our students, we're just much more, we're verbally approachable and in contact with them, but we're much more physically separate. And we stay out of situations that the student could misconstrue. We don't take them out to meals, for example. If a student is wanting counseling from me or having trouble or wanting to talk to me, I say, come to my office. You know, it's neutral turf. It's not really neutral turf, but it's sort of. And, I mean, some people say, well, professors' offices are worse than a public restaurant. And if there's that feeling, some of the men in my staff feel that way, and they say, I'd rather meet someone in the coffee house that's public than in my office, which is private. And they do that. We've talked through and thought through in our institution in a way that's supportive of all of us, because none of us wants to hurt someone and none of us wants to be misunderstood. And we do want to have our students thrive on our attention and not be hurt by it. And I think that's terribly important. When I've done counseling with someone who's been accused of this, who has denied and denied and denied that he had any intention of doing this, I have to say, well, listen to me. What you have done has hurt someone. Not intentionally. You didn't mean to do it, you're telling me. But it did hurt someone. Someone did think this. So you must consider what you did to make that person feel that way. And then they say, and then they're sort of stuck because they can't deny someone else's feelings. So then I rehearse, well, what kinds of ways could you change your behavior that wouldn't cause those feelings in someone else? Of course, in my heart of hearts, I always think, well, he's a dirty old man. That's why he gave those feelings. But that's not useful. That's not helpful to say to him. And the helpful thing is, what can we talk about in your behavior that you should change?
Do they change their behavior?
Yeah, and because they know I'm watching them like a hawk.
In that situation, they might. What is your, in long term?
But on campuses, they usually don't, in fact.
Change their behavior.
Change your behavior, they get away with it.
That's a question I had. Do people who sexually abuse others change their behavior even after therapy, counseling, and programs? Because St. Peter State Hospital, dismal in Minnesota, which harbors some of the United States' worst sexual offenders and criminals. And they have not had good luck at all. In fact, terrible.
Well, there's no guarantees. Whenever we talk about working with sex offenders, we always talk about recovery. We don't talk about cure. And part of that recovery is based in, but we're shifting a lot here. There's lots of different varieties of people who get involved in sexual offending. I have a person that I work with in Washington who I respect his opinion a lot, and he does not believe that there is any difference at all. I do believe there's a difference. And so, you know, right here, you're going to hear two different kinds of sides. I believe there are some people who, depending on 37 different variables and some controls we can set up, yes, we can get some behavior change and we can get people to be in strong recovery and be able to be in productive positions. Now, if we have someone who's a pedophile and they're sexually responsive to, you know, we can get pretty good at this. So we know that somebody sexually responsive to prepubescent females, and there's an age range of 3-4 years, and that's what his sexual arousal pattern is too. I believe that we can do some other things to work with that person in recovery, but I don't want that person to have access to prepubescent females. I mean, no, ever, never. And when that person is a Sunday school teacher who wants to work in that area, I say, no, you can never work in that specific area. But that isn't to say that with whole lots of other things, we can't have them work productively in some areas, but not. Now, I'm talking about a full-blown diagnosed pedophile now who we know that that's where they're predominant sexual responses. No, I don't think we can do that. We don't know yet how to do anything with that, anybody that I've ever heard of. So we can put some controls on that.
My gut level response is I want him off the street. I mean, that's my emotional response, is I don't want him near my children. I don't want him on the streets. And then I don't think we... You know, when they're identified, I want them out of here.
Sure.
I want them shipped, you know, on some island that they can't get off.
One of the things that I guess I can say, because I've taken, I hope, a strong enough victim position or victim stance here, that now I can speak something of the other side. I believe that there are a lot of people who are involved in sexual misconduct issues who... statistically, if we're talking about sexual misconduct issues, and you know, the garden variety wide range, you're probably talking 6 to 8% of our total population, maybe 20% of the males, somewhere in there. But if you're talking about pedophiles, maybe you're talking about 0.5%. So see, we're really, it's not all the same. The person who is in a power position and sets up and grooms his secretary and has done that for the last 20 years and sets that up is not the same person who molests children. I mean, there are some differences there. And it's scary to me to have somebody who does that. And I can understand your gut reaction. I don't have a different gut reaction necessarily, but I do know that the way our legal system is set up, and I don't necessarily feel bad about this, is that you can only be put in jail for that which you have done. You can't be put in jail for that which someone is fearful you might do. And it'd be pretty scary if that wasn't the way it was. So, it'd be scary for me anyway. I hate to have somebody get in my head and say, I'm going to put you in jail because this is something you might do. So that gets pretty scary. Yes. Or no, you're supposed to.
No, go ahead.
What about that California debacle, though? Too?
Mike Martin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what kind of legal defense do children really have in this country?
Well, most attorneys will tell you that I work with, if you got enough money and you can get a good attorney, you can take any child witness and absolutely destroy them. Always take it to court. Any attorney will tell you, if you are accused, if you are the most heinous child molester in the world and you got enough money to get you a good attorney, you can turn a child witness around completely. Now, I hope you know that I'm not speaking in favor of that. I'm just saying that's the way it is. I think the McMartin debacle, my own, I've done just a ton of reading around that, and my own belief about that is that it's a farce at every level. I don't think there was any question that there was sexual abuse. The question was how it was handled from a legal standpoint, and the question is, see, you get into little things like you can't lead a jury. So, I'm just going to give you one example. You take a child, and you know from child development that, let's say one little point with children, that children will give you inconsistent times and places. You know, one will be 10 o'clock, and, well, no, I think that was after lunch, and they'll say things like that. Well, when you're a witness in a case, you're not allowed to tell the jury that that's normal for a child of that age, because that's called leading the jury, so you can't do that. So then what the attorney who reads the same books I read will do is take that child and destroy them because they're not consistent without the jury understanding. Do you see what I'm saying?
Sure.
So there's that. That's a whole legal thing, and that's not the clinical thing, and that's not the victim thing, but that's the way the system is. So then you have to work real hard, and I heard both of you saying this at an adult level, you have to work real hard with parents to try to decide, is it worth putting your children through this? See, many, many cases are dropped, either because, and I'd say more cases that I get involved, many more that I get involved in are dropped for two reasons. One is because the prosecuting attorney will tell you, I know this guy's guilty, but I don't think we've got a solid enough case, and I'm not about to spend $500,000 of taxpayers' money to get him, but I know he's guilty. Prosecutor will tell me that, you know, regardless of which side I'm on. But we're going to drop the case because we don't think we can win the case. It has nothing to do with whether he did it or not. That's one issue where cases get dropped a lot. Another issue where cases get dropped a lot is because you, working with the victim, come to a point where you say, I don't think they can go through with it. I think it's going to be more damaging for them to go up and get battered and accused. And my experience in that is that you're not sure who's on trial. You know, so you have to evaluate that and say, no, it isn't worth it, so you drop it. And I got off on a tangent. That's a tough issue,
though.
That
was helpful. Well, I'm interested now. We only have about, I don't know, 6 or 8 minutes left to talk about the church's role more specifically. What some of you think, as far as now going back to your own congregations, what, given the high number of victims and of accusations or the increasing number, what should we as a church community be doing? Should we have sessions like this? I mean, should we bring the issue into our congregation even if we're not facing something immediately? Or should more sermons be preached on the issue so more victims felt free to come forward? Or should we be trying to look for reconciliation, or what do you think in all this as far as the church?
I think the first place is that the church has to begin talking about sexuality. Mm-hmm. You can't go into these things until you talk about sexuality.
Say more about what that should look like in a congregation.
It somehow should be made clear, I think, through curricula and through sermons, through confirmation and other outlets, that sexuality is a gift from God. You know, sort of bring it out of the closet. And I'm not sure how to follow from that point, but it's something you can celebrate, although it can also certainly be misused in many ways.
I just think it's terribly important to go back to what I said at the beginning, that prevention is a group activity, and to talk about it like in youth groups. If you had had language for your situation when you were 18, if you knew that you had a right to say no, you know, I think kids can be trained, teenagers can be trained, college students can be trained, adults can be trained. You know, if we talk about it and bring it to consciousness and think about it, then you think about creeps and you think about the fact that you don't have to put up with them. And you can work, you know, there, you learn ways to handle it.
We're doing trainings in the Lake Washington School District right now, and that's the only one right now that we're doing. With all the sixth graders and all the ninth graders, we do a training with them that we call Just Ask Why. Why do you want me to come over to your house after work? And, you know, and the very same kind of thing. Going over with sixth graders and ninth graders, because that's the one group that we can hit. Everybody then in junior high and everybody in high school, and they're doing some things at the elementary level that we're not doing, to get them to question and talk about and have some of the words and do those very kinds of things.
I think that's real important, to not just give them the words, but actually role model, mm-hmm. you know, do models.
Role play.
Dan, did you have
I'm not quite sure how to phrase it in terms of necessarily the church context, but it's a real debate or dilemma I feel for myself in terms of how to create healthy communities where touch is an integrated part of that, because I really believe that's important, but where also power abuses get called on that. And part of my experience is working with gay and lesbian people who've just been absolutely starved for having any sense of constructed healthy touch in their lives, and so how to create communities where that can happen, but where it's not a setup for exploitation and so forth. I know from my own experience, you know, the year I spent in Holden, where there was a lot of touch going on, was a really healing year for me. And I know that can be abused. I imagine for other people in Holden, it could be not that way. But for me, that was a really important year to find again a community where I could build some trust up and have touch be part of that. And so I don't know if any of the panelists have insights on ways that I think, Ingrid, some of your things about it, always having to be a group activity where it gets talked about, where you learn to recognize safe and unsafe behaviors and touch things are really critical. But I guess I get afraid or saddened sometimes, and sometimes the discussions almost begin to equate, we have to just stop touching in order to prevent this from happening. Maybe we're at a point where our societal dynamics are so sick we have to do that. But I would hope not, because I think, if you look at the histories of people who perpetrated these offenses, so oftentimes precisely because they were starved for any sense of, healthy sense of touching in their lives, and the only touching they may have gotten may have been sexual abuse themselves.
I'm a single parent, and I can identify with the, you know, touch issue, because I don't want that to go away. And I want it to be good and healthy. And one just sort of rule I have is to always ask permission.
The thing we do in teacher trainings, because this is the same thing we run into, where with anguish and anger, I will hear, "Oh, you're just telling us we can't touch kids anymore." And we know it's, you know, ta-da-da-da-da, and I really believe that. And the two pieces that we keep trying to hammer and come back to is pay attention to where you touch, ask permission to touch.
Where on the body?
Where on the body?
Like the head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And ask permission to touch. And do twice as much of it as you used to. That's what we always say to people. You know, so you're in the classroom and you walk in, you know, and you're walking, "Can I touch you on the shoulder?" And I don't know, "Can I touch you on the shoulder?"
Sure.
You know, and do that kind of thing. And do more of it, and do more of it, and do more of it. And, you know, that's because I think we have to do that. And if we're going to be careful about how and where we touch, then we could move into that thing of then not touching. So I always try to say to people, be conscious of it. Do twice as much as what you used to do, but pay attention to how you do it and what you touch. So that's
And you were saying to me earlier, like, you tell teachers not in the small, the back, but shoulders is okay. And
shoulders, back of the head, the arms, you know, but you don't get down in the buttocks area, you know, it's pretty common sense stuff. Most of us know what it's okay to touch and what it's not okay to touch. It's, I think, when we get frightened or angry or defensive and we get just frustrated and think, "Oh my gosh, you can't," you know, that really, and it is sad. It is sad if we're to the point where it's so bad that we can't touch, and yet, But let me hear one more thing that I think it's real important to ask. It slows my hugging down, but I ask.
So what about like at the passing of the peace in church? Let's just finish with that, really touch you on. I mean, I think a lot of us experienced Holden as sort of a real huggy place. I started coming here in 1973 and couldn't believe how people hugged each other at the passing of the peace. Well, at that point, I had never even heard of the passing of the peace. And that certainly meant a lot to me and has meant a lot to me over the years. But now I'm also sensitive to the large number of people for whom touch is not always good, and that the hugs in churches or whatever are maybe not always positive. Now, we talked about side hugs. Is that what this is? Is that a side hug? Anybody, any final words on that whole question, and that which Dan sort of brought up in Bill's?
I understand the children can become very, very abnormal if they don't have that touch of the parent or whoever. And I guess I was also kind of feeling, after I heard this, that our society is certainly getting a little bit paranoid on this. I have a feeling. Now, maybe there are these problems and so forth, but I've been in places like an airport in Jordan and in Greece and so forth, and people there are men are kissing, you know, and that's another society, but things are not necessarily wrong if there's the right mental attitude, I think. Maybe that's where we sometimes paint a broad, you know, use a broad brush and make everything wrong, and I guess it has to be, there's the right attitude in the background that has to be recognized, I think.
Well, we're at 9:30 here, so I think we better end. We certainly haven't resolved anything, but I think we've heard from a lot of different perspectives anyway, and I just invite you to continue the conversation at breakfast or coffee break tomorrow or tonight here if you want to stick around. Especially a thank you to your panelists and to those of you who shared stories of your own experience. I really appreciate that kind of vulnerability, and thank you for gracing us with your story.